It's time for Football Friday with Bill Savage, presented by Boyd's Royal Night on Government Boulevard in Mobile, featuring $8 weekday lunch specials, analysis, and insights. The winners, the losers, get ready for the weekend with Football Friday on FM Talk 106.5.
All right, we have arrived. It is Football Friday right here on FM Talk 106.5, brought to you by Boyd's Royal Night. And we say hello to our buddy Phil Savage, a general manager with not just the AAF Alliance Arizona, but the Arizona Hotshots now, also football guru extraordinaire to every radio show and TV show worth its salt, also the host of the podcast Football Philosophy, author of Fourth and Goal Every Day, and a homeboy, and one of my friends. Phil Savage, good morning.
Well, good morning, Sean. Hope you guys are well. I'm telling you, it's early here in the desert. I'm actually in Arizona this week, and I'll be going to the Arizona State-Oregon State game tomorrow. But more importantly, let's talk a little hot shot football.
Yeah, what is that? And let's back up. If people just joined us and not heard us over the past month or so, AAF, Alliance, and then the team out of Arizona.
Yeah, so the Alliance of American Football is slated to kick off February 2019. It's a spring league. It's not going to compete with the NFL. It's trying to be an augmentation to the NFL. And so anyhow, we revealed our logo and team name earlier in the week. And when I first got the news on Monday that we're going to be the Hot Shots, I'm like, what is this? You know, is this Papa Shot? My kids were saying Hot Pockets. I mean, you know, we don't know what's going on. But then they send the follow-up with the logo and the meaning behind the name, and it's a tribute to the 100 elite firefighting units across the western United States, and specifically in Arizona. So it's been well-received out here in the Valley. They're very proud of the Hot Shots, and you can imagine the different promotions that are going to take place in conjunction with the Shots.
Right. I'm thinking of many of them, you know, on the Shot side. Also on the hot part of it, you know, do you have the big hot Cheeto thing where everybody's eating the hot Cheeto fries or whatever? Maybe give out, you know, bags of those as you come into the stadium.
Oh, yeah, you got that. And then I did not know this, you know, the pickaxe that they use to build those trench lines, that's called a Pulaski. I thought Pulaski was in Tennessee, but it's actually that axe handle, and they had one of the U.S. Forest firefighters at our event on Wednesday night, and he explained, you know, a lot about what goes into the teamwork, and then the skill set, and obviously the courage and the bravery that goes into being a hot shot. So here we are.
Yeah, and the nice thing is, too, just to add to the mix, you talk about athletes, maybe not with the technique for football, but if you look at the men and women that do that parachute firefighting or the remote western wildfire firefighting,
oh yeah,
they go 4,000 or 5,000 feet of elevation each day, swinging that Pulaski, making those trench lines, fighting those fires, all while in smoke and full gear. I mean, those folks are in shape,
tough.
Phil. They are tough and in shape.
Yeah, it's no joke, and I think they've already, you know, got a lot of promotions that will be in the works in terms of trying to honor these guys and gals that are part of the Hot Shots here in Arizona. And we're playing at Sun Devil Stadium, and so they just did a $300 million renovation to Sun Devil Stadium. It's probably going. I'm assuming that it will be the best stadium in the Alliance of the eight teams that are going to play. So we're excited about it. Rick Neuheisel's our coach, and Rick and I, of course, do work for SiriusXM, so we're flying under the banner of the SiriusXM Hot Shots as well. We're the adopted team of satellite radio.
Well, I'm looking forward to that league getting started after the NFL season wraps up, but right now we're in the middle of a already incredible college football season. But before we talk about the games this weekend, Phil, I got to get your thoughts on a new movement in college football, and with the news that Clemson senior quarterback Kelly Bryant is transferring after he started the first four games of the season, now that they named Trevor Lawrence the starting quarterback up there in Clemson. I wanted to get your thoughts with these new NCAA transfer rules. Is this the new normal? Will this be like a transfer deadline week that we look towards every year to see who's moving on from their college?
If the rule stays in place as is, it absolutely will be a fault line in terms of the college football season. And this is, you know, one of those unintended consequences of something that is actually favoring the players. It takes some of the leverage away from the coaches at the college level. And, you know, the headline of the week was Kelly Bryant leaving the Clemson program after starting 18 games there, going 16-2. This is the situation and circumstance that could easily have led to Jalen Hurts doing the same thing. Obviously, Alabama had talked through, and Jalen and Nick Saban and the families, they probably had discussed this as one of the options. He clearly is going to stay at Alabama and be part of this team because that's what he wants to do. He wants to graduate from Alabama and then likely move on. My question is, as gifted as Trevor Lawrence is, what happens in 2 weeks if Trevor Lawrence sustains some sort of season-ending injury? Will Clemson scramble back and try to bring Kelly Bryant back onto their roster? And, you know, it wasn't just Kelly Bryant. Mm-hmm. We saw a number of players across the country. Nate Craig Myers, a receiver from Auburn, he also did the same thing. So it is absolutely a form of free agency at the collegiate level. You guys could spend an absolute entire show on this topic.
And it could lead to eventually pretty bad quarterback play if, like you said, some of these highly touted guys that come in and earn the job and everyone behind them leaves, then you're left with walk-ons. Like, say Jalen Hurts did leave, you would just have Mac Jones backing up Tua Tagovailoa, and I'm not sure Alabama fans would want him leading them into an SEC championship game.
Yeah, and that's the danger that Clemson will have to negotiate here over the next few weeks and into the remaining part of the season. But, you know, I said on my podcast 3 weeks ago, after seeing Clemson play Texas A&M, I said, look, Clemson can't win the national championship with Kelly Bryant at the quarterback position. It worked that night because they were simply the better team. But a dual-threat quarterback who is a better runner than passer, I don't think you can win the national title that way because these defenses are so good. They squeeze the run game out of your offense, and now it's on the right or left shoulder, whichever the throwing side is, of the quarterback. And you've got to be able to throw yourself out of 3rd and 8, 3rd and 10, 3rd and 12. Bama couldn't do it last year with Jalen Hurts. They made the move at the 11th hour of the last game, second half versus Georgia. Clemson saw the writing on the wall. They say, hey, we're going with Trevor Lawrence now. And I made the comparison of what Alabama went through last year with Tua on the practice field versus Jalen Hurts in the game action. And Clemson was in the same situation this year. They pulled the trigger much earlier, and now it's led to Bryant leaving and everything being put onto the shoulders of Trevor Lawrence, the true freshman quarterback.
Last weekend, Auburn beat Arkansas 34-3, but I get the sense that the coaching staff and the fans weren't really happy with the offensive performance. They do play Southern Miss tomorrow, which they shouldn't have too much trouble with. Southern Miss is a pretty good team. But when, Phil, will this Auburn offense get rolling again, or will they?
Yeah, I think the biggest issue for Auburn right now is just the combination of their offensive line and the run game. And, you know, they lost a good number of offensive linemen to graduation in the NFL in the offseason. This Gus Malzahn offense always centers around their ability to run the ball and pick up 5, 6, 7 yards on first down, because then once it goes to 2nd and 3 or 3rd and 2, it's almost an impossible offense to stop. So their first down production is the number one factor that they've got to improve relative to, you know, previous seasons. So that's what they've got to get going. And, you know, I don't know the individual talent up front enough to say whether they're going to improve dramatically over the next few weeks. But I will say this to your Alabama listeners. Never pay attention to what Auburn's doing in September and October. It does not matter, because when they show up for the Iron Bowl, it's always a completely different team.
Very well said. Pretty big game for Bulldogs fans in Starkville tomorrow. Mississippi State hosting Florida at 5 p.m. Of course, Dan Mullen returning to Starkville for the first time as the head coach of the Florida Gators, and the Gators 7-point underdogs tomorrow. What are your thoughts on this game?
Yeah, a lot of emotions at stake here. Of course, Dan Mullen was at stake for 9 years, and the Bulldog fans feel like, hey, you know, he should still be here for a 10th year. He left us for greener pastures. I think if Mississippi State's team and players are worried about Dan Mullen, then they'll be in danger of playing poorly for a second week in a row. And, you know, last Saturday night against Kentucky, they had 16 penalties in that game against the Wildcats. They got punched in the mouth up front on both sides of the ball, which was surprising to most that watched that game. But Kentucky's legit, and Mississippi State thought they were. They lose this game, essentially they'll be a good SEC team, but they'll be out of the running in the SEC West. So this is a must-win for Mississippi State at home against Florida. I think they'll rebound and play better than they did against Kentucky. And as we know, Kentucky was clearly the better team than Florida. So I think State can get this done at home.
And speaking of Kentucky, ranked for the first time since 2007 now, they come in at number 17 on the AP poll. Yeah. But they have probably what looks like the closest game, at least on paper this weekend, when South Carolina comes to Lexington. How long can Mark Stoops, Benny Snell Jr., and that Wildcats defense keep this up, Phil?
You know, I think that this is a sustainable team this year. And the reason I say that, they've got a veteran offensive line. Benny Snell's one of the best running backs in the conference, if not in the entire country. And, you know, the one thing that does not abandon you when you're a physical team is that mentality and that ability to just turn and hand the ball to the best player on your team. The other thing I would say is that Josh Allen, the outside backer for Kentucky, he's one of the best defensive players in the country who had no recognition until they beat Mississippi State the other day. He dominated that game. He's a game-changing pass rusher. And I tell you, if you know, this is going to be the real test for Kentucky. They're starting to have success. They're still undefeated. They've beaten South Carolina four times in a row. They're trying to make it a fifth time in a row. You look at their schedule, and we might be a month from now talking about an undefeated Kentucky hosting an undefeated Georgia on November the 3rd.
What?
Unbelievable. That would just be insane. And and just I want to wrap it up with a personal question here, Phil. This is one that probably I'm the only one that cares about here, but Kentucky, a team that's climbing in the SEC East. The Tennessee Vols, a team that has fallen very, very fast. But I noticed this weekend, more than any other game this year with the Vols, when they lost to Florida pretty badly, new head coach Jeremy Pruitt seemed more frustrated than he had been. Even a linebacker, he says, Corte Sapp, quit, and he sent him off the sideline. He refused to go into the game. I just wanted to know, with Pruitt coming from Alabama and that background that he has, when Nick Saban took over after Mike Shula, that first year, those first couple of years, how hard was that process for some of the players to start playing under a tough head coach like Nick Saban, like the Vols are doing under Jeremy Pruitt right now?
Well, remember this, in Nick Saban's first year, Bama was 7-2, okay? Mm-hmm. And they were in it until they lost a tough game to LSU. And, I mean, LSU had 20 NFL players and Alabama had like two. So Bama hung in there, but when they lost that game and they were out of it, remember, they lost four games in a row. They were 7-6 all of a sudden, including a loss to UL Monroe. And, you know, the seniors and the older group of players, they gave up the ghost. And Tennessee might be on the verge of giving up the ghost a little earlier than Alabama because I'm telling you, when you watch the body mannerisms and the body language from both players and coaches, it was ugly last Saturday night against Florida in Neyland Stadium. So I thought for the first time, look, Jeremy Pruitt, this is the first time he'll ever be a head coach. He's been involved in a lot of winning, not a lot of losing. And so to be able to manage this circumstance is really going to be the first – this is going to be the biggest challenge of his first year, is holding all of it together and keeping a carrot dangling in front of his football team. And, you know, the other night, that clearly was not the case. They did not look motivated, especially once they fell behind.
There he is, Phil Savage.
And that's where you're not supposed to look at the scoreboard. Mm-hmm. And that's where that mental training that Alabama has accomplished over the last decade, it doesn't matter what the score is, they're going to play every rep as if it's their last, Hence the book, Fourth and Goal Every Day.
That's what I was saying. Nice transition into Fourth and Goal Every Day, how that applies in our lives, right, outside of football.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you can mentally train yourself that it doesn't matter what happened 5 minutes ago or what's going to happen 5 minutes from now, it only matters to right at this particular moment. And to get 100 college players and all your staff into that same mindset is an impossibility, except Alabama's done it now for the last 10 years.
Phil Savage, he is GM of, now we can say, not just the AAF Alliance Arizona, the Arizona Hotshots, and y'all start play, when is it?
First weekend after the Super Bowl, so February the 9th. We will begin in earnest, but it's going to be a lot of fun. It's a great concept, and I tell you, you know, we've signed almost 70 players now, so we only have a few more spots left for our training camp roster. So it's a reality. Every time I leave the house, my wife says, "Hey, this is a real thing." And I'm like, "You better believe it's a real thing, and I'm a hot shot."
There you go. That's for, and also, of course, our buddy, a host of the SEC podcast, Football Philosophy, author of Fourth and Goal Every Day, and the genius, the guru behind Football Fridays, Phil. As always, thank you so much, and we'll talk to you next week.
Too kind, Sean. You guys be good. Have a great weekend. We'll catch up next Friday.
All right, we'll do. Phil Savage, check it in. Brought to you by Boyd's Royal Knight. And by next week, what number game is that? 1, 2, 3.
We'll be entering week 6.
Weeks
after this weekend.
See, that's it's exciting, but also depressing because then, like, you see the end coming, too.
Yeah, we're almost halfway through the season already.
Wow. All right. 823 FM Talk 106.5. Be right back. Hey, thank you, Kane. 827 FM Talk 106.5 and Mobile Mornings. On the way, Finance Director for the City of Mobile, Paul Wesch, joins us. We'll talk more about the 10 changes City Council made to the budget and what actually would kick in a federal issue here on the grant money for Gulf Quest. What is it on the raise for public service employees? We'll get into all that. The 10 budget items, we posted those earlier in the week. You can read through them, but we'll continue that conversation coming up after 8:30. Hey, the weekend is here. What a great time. If you've not been able to get out to the Original Oyster House during the week, which I think is a great move, a clutch move, if you haven't been able to do it during the week, you can do it on the weekend as well. And what I like, once again, I'm going to get in so much trouble. The Gulf Shores location is fantastic. It's the original Oyster House. It's got the great food, the great store that goes with it, the beautiful view of Little Lagoon. All those things are fantastic. It's in South Baldwin. That's fantastic. But I got to tell you, I spend my time on the Causeway. That's where the Causeway location, that's where I go. And Causeway location number one, we've talked about those $6.99 apps, dollar off drafts, Monday through Friday. Also talking about the live tunes going on. But over the weekend, great time to get out there. And if you're in the boat this weekend, you listen to Captain Bobby's Fishing Report, and you're fired up to do a little fishing in the north end of the bay or the Causeway, one of the great things about living here is having great seafood and the ability to pull up a boat and tie it up and go in and have lunch.
So awesome.
It is a nice way. It is a nice day. If you're going to be on the Causeway, you fish or riding, whatever you want to do, whether you're in a motorized boat or you're kayaking or whatever, you pull up. They got the dock right there, little floater dock next to the bulkhead. You tie up, you walk inside, get lunch, enjoy lunch a little time, and then get back out and go fishing or riding around. So enjoy so many things that make the life along the Gulf Coast great. And you can do that also, yes, at the original Oyster House in Gulf Shores, but I'll probably see you at the Mobile Bay Causeway location. Check them out online, originaloysterhouse.com. All right, coming up, like I said, we'll talk to Finance Director with the City of Mobile, Paul Wesch. Also, we'll get Dr. Bill's forecast and an update on what's going on in Washington, because right now, I think, if what we were told earlier today, they should be taking the committee vote on confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh, right?
Yep, that is supposed to occur at 8:30 this morning. And some of the leaks are coming through about who's voting what. It does appear one political reporter, Sung Min Kim, she says Flake will vote to confirm Judge Kavanaugh. Flake, one
of those. Called the vote, when Mitch McConnell calls for the vote, that tells you they probably had figured out the Republican defectors they had worried about may not be defecting now. Now, what about Democrats? Well, we got a pretty certain email here last night. From Doug Jones, said he will not be voting for confirmation. So Senator Doug Jones, one of our two senators, a no vote for confirming Kavanaugh. Yeah, how surprised are people? Scale 1 to 10. Right. All right. Coming right back. A36 FM Talk 106.5 and Mobile Mornings. Glad to have you here on this Friday. Dr. Bill putting the weekend weather scale in the 1.7 range, which, you know, compared to the rainy week we've had, isn't all too bad. And it's getting highs in the 90s by the weekend and a fewer showers. It's not completely dry, but fewer showers. More details coming up in just a few minutes right here on Mobile Mornings. Phone number, text line 343-0106, 343-0106. It was Tuesday when I first got the note here of what had been voted on by the Mobile City Council and these changes, amendments to the budget, right? So we're coming up on the new fiscal year, end of this fiscal year, time to have the budget up. And there were 10 amendments put through. And we've talked about it a bunch on the show this week, kind of going through the different line items here and things that were changed. And earlier in the week, Mayor Sandy Stimson joined us on the midday show to talk about that. And then yesterday, Mobile City Councilman John Williams came in with what he came in with his position. And he said the position of the City Council, which, by the way, City Council voted 6-0 unanimously because Joel Days was absent, 6-0 to approve these budget changes here for the budget. And now, speaking of the budget, Finance Director of the City of Mobile, Paul West, joining us in studio to talk more about it. Thanks for being here.
Morning, Sean.
Morning. Good morning.
Let's talk about some of the things that have been, first of all, kind of the process of this. And I brought it up with the mayor earlier in the week, but I'd like you to bring it back up. So the normal procedure is the administration, the executive branch, produces a budget. Y'all put a budget together, correct?
That's correct. The we have a true separation of powers form of government. So the mayor has the responsibility to deliver a proposed budget to the city council by August 20th, and the council has the authority to amend and adopt under the Zogby Act that dictates our form of government. They're supposed to deliver that budget back on September 20th.
Okay, so that's a normal procedure. Whatever given year, the executive branch will produce the budget, give it to the council. The council then looks at it and says whatever changes they want to make or no changes and then hands it back over.
Correct.
Okay. In that process, what's happened here? What's happened this year?
Well, in this particular year, the mayor did deliver the budget on time. The council considered the budget, had one public hearing that they're required to hold by law to hear from citizens and interested parties. They held one city council finance committee meeting, and then at the city council meeting this past Tuesday, presented and adopted 10 amendments, mm-hmm. and then adopted the amended budget.
All right. So those 10 changes here, budget amendment 1 through 10, all deal with moving, at least in my eyes, and obviously you have savvier eyes, shifting money from one area of the budget to another, right?
Correct.
So it's not that it's is increasing the overall budget, it's reallocating funds from one place to another.
That's right. The city council does not have authority to create revenue. So they, when they choose to amend, they must do so within the total budget expenditures.
Okay. Kelly.
Paul, good morning. My question is what do you think is the biggest misconception when it comes to this budget and what we as citizens are hearing through the various outlets?
I think that has to do with how the mayor prioritizes. As he is fond of saying, and I think accurately so, government exists to deliver central government services to the citizens at the least possible expense. And so in a world of finite resources, as always exists, the mayor prioritizes public safety first, police and fire. If we have money left over after those two have been addressed, then public health, sanitation, garbage pickup, and EMS services provided by fire and rescue. Money left over after that, the citizens expect infrastructure, streets and sidewalks that they can ride and walk on, drainage facilities and the like. If there's money left over after that, then there are matters of recreation and entertainment for citizens. again, affecting health and welfare, such as the creation and maintenance of parks, recreation facilities. After that, there are some, I'll call them discretionary areas that are not central city services. And there are many applicants for funding in those areas. Lots of really good nonprofits with good missions who would love to be funded at levels higher than what they are funded at.
And that was going to be my question, because we heard from nonprofits. You know, Councilman Williams was here yesterday, and he brought up Penelope House and the importance of what Penelope House does for our battered women and our families, and how programs like that being sliced really impacts the families as a whole, and people wanting to know, why would we choose to cut something like that when it seems so vital?
Yeah, and that would be true with respect to every one of those nonprofits in that list that that had been recommended for a slight decrease. If you know, you look at all of those performance contract providers, their missions are cannot be argued with. They're necessary. They do good work. They do that work in good faith. So when it comes time to divvy out those finite resources, you are, in effect, always going to be cutting into the muscle of worthy organizations. In putting this budget together, initially in a $309 million finished budget, we had about $330 million worth of requests.
Just get a little closer. As you say, yeah, getting a little closer to the mic there. Yeah, and I want to, no, that was it. I just want to get you where people could hear you more clearly. If you're just joining us, finance director with the city of Mobile, Paul Wesch, in the studio, talking about that part. But I want to start off at budget amendment number one. That's where I want to go, because that has been one of the bigger discussions here and maybe misunderstandings going on. And it says budget amendment number one from the council, decrease personnel, Gulf Quest, increase library. So the decrease to personnel Gulf Quest, Councilman Williams said that the city was paying, I think it was $1 million or so of Gulf Quest or Gulf Quest operations cost, and he said he could run it for less on the personnel side. What is the story there with Gulf Quest? Because I've told folks, this is not to get in to judge whether you like the idea that Gulf Quest was built or not, but it's kind of tell us what's real. What's real with what does it take? What's the minimum standard to keep Gulf Quest open to satisfy the federal grant money so we don't have to pay that back?
When the city was forced to take over Gulf Quest about 2 years ago, they were 42 employees.
Okay.
Employed by the foundation, the private foundation with no city affiliation. The city looked at the realities, knowing that Gulf Quest was funded with $26 million worth of federal grants, and if Gulf Quest did not fulfill its mission to continue the operation of a maritime museum, the city could be forced to pay back those grants. So the city began to look at what is the minimum level of funding required to maintain that commitment to the federal government.
What keeps us compliant, right?
Correct.
Okay.
And so we've been operating with either 8 or 9 city employees since that time. So a tremendous reduction. A skeleton crew exists, if you will.
From 42, you said, when the takeover?
Yes.
To 9. Okay.
That's right. And so in addition to those this year 9 employees at the $496,000 salary and benefit level, there's about $500,000 worth of utilities and service contracts to maintain the building.
Can I call that, is that fixed cost? Is that, would that be, I mean, probably overly simplified, but I mean, it's non-personnel.
Correct. And in fact, it's very simple. About $400,000 of that are electricity, water, and gas.
Okay. So, I mean, basically, yeah, the utilities, like at the house, you know, what it takes to keep it going. So, essentially, I mean, I know you'll tell me the actual percentage, but half and half to me, half is the upkeep is the fixed cost, half is personnel.
Correct.
Okay. So, what happens when you have a $496,161 cut here to decrease personnel at Gulf Quest?
Well, all the employees are eliminated, so the building would be closed. It would be maintained, heated and cooled.
Okay.
And there would be necessary services provided, guard services to maintain security around the building, and certain other building services to maintain the structure.
Okay. But that's still the way I understand this, and correct me, even with it heated and cooled so it doesn't get mold and all those things, are we compliant with the federal grant?
No. No, that would not maintain the operation of a maritime museum.
So what then happens? What could happen? I mean, because I you know, went off the premise that if we fail to live up to the contract, the feds do the clawback, call for the money back. I was told by Councilman Williams that's probably not going to happen. Even heard from Rob Holbert, said, well, he didn't think it would happen. There's not, you know, a bunch of places being sued by the feds out there. Right?
Well, you know, to disavow risk that in that cavalier manner is irresponsible, in my view. We spoke with the FTA when this amendment occurred on Tuesday. And the reason we did was this first came up 2 years ago. The city council at that point had trouble with the same concept. FTA surveils the media here, mm-hmm. found out immediately that the foundation had failed. And
you're doing some self-reporting.
Yes. The risk of not doing so is kind of great, too. So 2 years ago, FTA asked us about the situation. We mm-hmm. told them that the city was struggling to find a way to keep it open. They worked with us and did not bring the hammer down, so to speak, for the temporary closing.
Right.
And as the city began to fund some necessary personnel and expenses at the museum, FTA became comfortable with the limited resources that the city was supplying.
A renegotiated understanding, maybe? Is that fair, Paul, to
say? That's correct.
Okay. So that's what we've been working off of. And we're going to run to the news break and coming right back, talk more about this and other budget items changed. The employee raises, I want to get into that as well, because was read first what the budget said, the budget amendment said. I heard read what the mayor said on Twitter earlier in the week, then heard from Councilman Williams on this yesterday, so I want to hear from you on this as well. As we continue right here on Mobile Mornings on FM Talk 106.5, 848, we'll check in with Dr. Bill coming up. Thanks, Kane. 852 FM Talk 106.5 Mobile Mornings, and continuing our conversation. Sean Kelly, Dalton will be back with us next week. And we have Finance Director for the City of Mobile trying to shed some more light, also acting Chief of Staff for the City of Mobile, Paul Wesch, in the studio. And kind of going through, we won't be able to get to all these, but I want to get to, so we talked a bit about the situation with GulfQuest. The next one that seems to have caused some contention here is who's giving whom a raise? Maybe I'm overly simplifying this, but this idea that budget amendment number 7, a decrease to I-Team, and then it says the increase is earmarked for public works raises, which when added to the $896,860 already budgeted for incentive pay, results in $1,711,000 available for 5% merit raises to public works employees.
Sean, we don't know where that came from, frankly.
What do you mean? You don't?
We don't know. And
let me
tell you a little bit of the history here. When John Peavy, who is the executive director of Public Works, came aboard several months ago, he immediately began to address issues in Public Works with personnel and compensation. He found three areas that were fairly glaring. One was we were spending a lot more on overtime than we should because of absences, where people would not schedule that they were not going to show up, and so then you'd have to fill those spots with overtime. So John thought, boy, the best way to deal with this is to incentivize people to not be absent without leave.
Mm-hmm.
And so in one area of the budget that the mayor presented, John proposed, and the mayor agreed with, a bonus, if you will, or a slight increase in compensation to reward people who were deliberate in their their work schedules, showed up on time, or gave notice that they were not going to show up, and plenty of time for their superiors to plan around them. There was a second area where we could not get enough qualified people to fill what I'll call open seat jobs. An example of that would be the guy who operates the knuckle boom lift that picks up the trash.
For big trash, yeah.
Or the guy who operates the large lawnmower on the side of the road. Those people are in the weather all the time. They're subject to elements and tensions that the rest of us don't have. So he wanted to increase the pay of those people, the current employees, but also to be able to attract employees to fill vacant positions. So that was the second part of his deliberate approach to compensation adjustments. The third was a safety program to reward people who went a quarter without having injury to themselves or their equipment.
Okay.
That deliberate approach took the form of a written plan that was placed before the personnel board and approved. The cost of that was estimated to be
$896,000. Okay, that's the $896,000, okay.
And that was put into the budget. The city council asked us, well, how does that compare to a longevity raise? A longevity raise is, in our view, exactly what the police department has, which is a 2.5% increase for every 5 years that you're on the job, with a maximum of 4 of those increases.
Okay.
Measuring that into public works, that would cost $850,000, which number was delivered to the city council, slightly less than what was in the budget.
Okay.
Inexplicably, what came back from the council was a note that they wanted to increase the budget amount by $104,000 to grant a 5% across-the-board raise to all public works employees, which is fine, except that costs less than both of the prior measures.
Well, you say there's actually a decrease?
Yes, that would a 5% raise to all public works employees would cost $740,000. Beyond that, I have no knowledge of how the amendment made it into the numbers.
Okay, and so the numbers are not, other than the 896, you don't know where the other numbers came from.
Correct.
We get this before we run out of time here, because this is kind of hand in glove with this budget amendment number 7. And I know Kelly was talking about this. We're talking during the break, too. The decrease to the I-team and the increase to the Public Works Administration, or at least the decrease with the I-team. Talk about this. Councilman Williams talked about the budget for the Communications Department for the city and for the I-team. What's the story there?
Well, as I understand it, and George Talbot could tell us with better clarity, but most of the increase in the communications budget that was placed before the council had to do with non-salary items. One of those was a reconfiguring and redevelopment of the city's website, which, as you probably know, is rather tired and old and
right.
Needs a reboot.
Okay, so it's a non-personnel cost?
For the most part.
And get you a little closer to that mic. There you go.
For the most part. There may be some salary in there. I just don't recall as we sit here.
All right.
And with that website, is it designed because that can attract in more tourists in the city and keep the those residents informed as to what's going on with their respective city council members?
Primarily the latter, so that it would be, increased transparency, definition of services, the ability of residents and taxpayers to know what's going on.
So with this new budget, bottom line, you're hoping that this does what for the city?
In that area?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it doesn't exist now.
Altogether, the entire budget.
Uh-huh. We think that the budget, all told, as I think you probably can figure out, even these changes, as hurtful as a couple of them are, all in all, this budget maintains a great deal of what was in the prior budget and those before then, and delivers basic services to the citizens at what we think is a pretty good cost.
All right. As we end up running out of time on this, tell you what, maybe we'll continue this discussion in a forum here later on in the day. More on this coming up on Midday Mobile. We're out of here. Y'all have a great weekend.